Now, ladies and gentlemen, I've been in the audience, and I know that at times there's difficulty in distinguishing the words. So if you find that true this afternoon, let it be known so that we can correct it, please. In looking at our panel this afternoon, we've got them from all over the country and from overseas. I remember a story about a little gal. Little girl, she said, "Mama, you were born in New York. Papa was born in Los Angeles. And I was born in St. Louis. How did we all get together?" And, well, here we are. And I think the reason I'm here is because two men from Chicago, back in 1940, took time out to come up and look up a lone drunk in Minneapolis. I could be ever grateful for those men because I couldn't do it on the book. I ran across this big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, in the public library of Minneapolis in August of 1940. And there it was staring at me from the bookshelves. I'm coming off a 10-day drunk. And I was afraid to take that book off the shelf for fear somebody would connect me with alcohol. That's the kind of screwy thinking, the dishonest thinking that we are all subject to. Nevertheless, I found courage to take it off and take the wrapper off, which is very, very vivid, as you know, and sit down and try to read. I had no money, but a friend of mine sent away and bought the book, and that's how they got my address in New York, that they sent to Chicago, and these gentlemen came up. I got my copy of the book, and I stayed dry 2 whole weeks until I got a payday. And then I went off. I grabbed this book Sunday morning to read myself dry to get back to work Monday. So all I was looking for in this book was controlled drinking. I think that's what a lot of us are constantly looking for. And it wasn't until I saw two men who had been dry since the previous January, I saw two men who had made it, that I was able to make the surrender to the fact that maybe, just maybe, I could swallow this God stuff and make it myself. That was my stumbling block, as it was the stomach block of so many of you. And I really did some thinking, some meditating. I had to figure out how any deity could have any faith in myself. After all the promises and prayers of desperation that I'd sent up, how could he understand that this time I would try it under his care? But I started to pray. As they taught me, the Chicago men, both newspaper men, they typed it out and stuck it on the wall of my room. And my old Irish landlady, she couldn't figure out what was wrong with Cronin. He was paying his rent. And he was sober. And she told another old gal, and that old gal had her boy out in the workhouse. Would I get him out and work on him? Sure. So I pulled a few wires and met him at the probation agent at his office. I took him home and told his mother to keep him until tonight. I'll be out with the book and I'll give him the AA. So I went out at 7 o'clock. She says, "Well, Joe isn't back yet." Well, I said, "Well, where is he?" Oh, she says, "About 3 o'clock. He had to go down and get his watching his pants out of hock, and I give him $15. Well, Joe made the can that night in the workhouse the next morning. I didn't see him for 90 days. So whenever I get a little cocky, I think of Joe, and I get a little humble. Well, you're not interested in my story, folks. We have some wonderful speakers here this afternoon. They all have good stories to tell. And This is the first folks that I've met from AA from England. Our first speaker flew over, was fortunate enough to combine business with the convention to be with us. And of course, we're all anxious to hear how they do it in England. Mr. Ian Heath.
Ladies and gentlemen, I sincerely hope that you are not expecting from me an adaptation similar to which Winston Churchill would give. But I would like to say how very delighted I am to be here amongst you all and to try and express my gratitude and thanks to AA and all that it has done for me. It's just 9 years since I was chucked out of the family business. And they thought that I should call back after I'd had a fairly good beating. But like all alcoholics, I think we have a grain of stubbornness. So I started on my own in a small way in a very poor part of Birmingham. A toolmaker came with me. And for 18 months, I stayed a dry drunk. Then, one day, I met the doctor. And I asked him if he thought the candies would hurt me, which consists of half a pint of beer and the rest of lemonade. And he said no. But it wasn't long before I had 10 pints of beer and just one shandy lined up just to put a dash into it. Well, strangely enough, I'm happy to relate, I love work. And I chucked it, and then I'll start again. I'll try something else. Sherry. Well, one sherry didn't hurt me, but by God, a bottle did. 2 bottles. Then various things started to happen in my little business, and I chucked it again for another 12 months. Things went very well for me. And I thought, well, I've got round this corner. I still didn't realize I was an alcoholic and I'd never been told I was. Finally, after going on like this for another 3 or 4 years, on and off, I changed my doctor. I went to a Scotch fellow who now is one of my greatest friends. And he said, well, Ian, you're so bad now that you'll have to go into hospital. Well, I got into this hospital on a bottle and a half of brandy and thought the doctor there was a hell of a good fellow. And the next morning when I woke up with a shake to hear various people screaming and one thing and another, I thought I was completely round the bend. But luck was on my side. I'd only been in there 48 hours when a most charming individual came along, also an inmate, and said, "What are you in here for?" So I said, "I think it's drink." And he burst out laughing. I said, "Well, I don't see what there's to laugh about at the present moment." He said, "Go, old chap, I've been in here 4 times for the same thing." He said, "But at last I found the answer." And he dashed off and brought me the book on AA. Shaky as I was, and trying to concentrate on the book, I last realized that I was an alcoholic, and this is what I had been looking for so long. I immediately rode up to London headquarters and said, "I should like to become a member, and I sincerely want to stop drinking." When I came out, I was met by Steve, who has come with me on this wonderful trip. Just 3 years since I've been in AA. I believe you call them pigeons over here. And I met Steve, and we went to luncheon together. One of the biggest hotels in Birmingham, where I was well known for being able to consume a lot of liquor and make a general fool of myself. Anyway, we sat down and had a couple of ginger ales, and he started to talk to me. I then went to my first AA meeting, where there were 3 people. I was the 4th. I'm happy to tell you now that from those 4, there are 40. And as we didn't start this wonderful thing until 1947, we have now 80 groups in England and 5,000 members. But I must say, the old country has certainly learnt something very miraculous and wonderful from the new. And I look forward to the time when we shall be as up to date as you are here. I can't let this opportunity pass without thanking Marion of New York for her wonderful letters and assistance when this journey was first mooted. And it seemed from the very first of the correspondence that we were great friends. I can't tell you how overwhelmed we both are with the kindness that we have received from you all. Your hospitality and kindness in America is known throughout the world. And we very reserved Britishers find it more than difficult to know how to return such hospitality. Nevertheless, I would like to say that if at any time you should have the misfortune to visit Birmingham, England, I shall be more than delighted to see you. And so with these few words, I will conclude my speech with thanks and gratitude to AA. God bless you all.
I've always been impressed by the speedy maturity in AA of our Canadian presence. And I assure you, the same maturity seems to be prevalent among our British presence. You've heard of Damon and Pythias. Well, another combination of Damon and Pythias was formed 3 years ago. Damon has brought Pythias, Elias, Steve along, so Steve is going to give us a little song, too. One, two.
I'm afraid I'm very much in the same position as the young greenhorn who was told to get up at the ranch concert and sing. He couldn't sing, but he was doing his best. The four old men stand up at the back and pull out a six shooter. Then he really got frightened. The old boy said, "Go on, sonny, you're doing your best. I'm looking for the bugger that put you on the bill." I'm doing my best. I can't point out the so-and-so that put me on the bill. But of course, I'm very delighted to be here. Now, I'm an alcoholic. It isn't terribly important you should know that. What really matters is that I know. I found out the hard way. I come from a small town in the northwest of England, from a very happy home with a very religious background. Up to the time of being sent away to school, my mother read a chapter of the Bible to me every night. At school, I knew nothing but success. I was head boy of the school, and captain of school games. And there I went to the university, and again I knew nothing but captain. I was president of the university union, captain of games, and captain of the combined English university football team. I had an amazing time. Nothing but success. I was doing marvelously. I didn't drink. I very rarely smoked. Strangely enough, my halo didn't give me any headaches either. But when I left the university, I went to take a job with a mining company. It went on for many years with my technical qualifications, and eventually landed a job at an extraordinary early age with the government department. Another success. I must have been coming a terribly big shot. How big, I just didn't know. And then, over this period, up to the age of 30, I had drunk very little. What I didn't know, what I can see now, was the pattern was there even on those very odd occasions when I drank. Even at dinners at the end of football tours, at 21st birthday parties, I was always a bloke that put the other fellows in a taxi when I went to look for another drink. But even so, it was no problem. Until about the year 1937, I left a very promising job I had with the department and went to a private company. It was even more promising still. There were no fields that I couldn't have conquered. And when eventually I met John Barleycorn, well, even the heavens were not unconquerable. Well, I'm not going to bore you with the following pattern of alcoholism. I have heard people say what they lost through drinking, loss of wife, home, cars, and all that sort of thing, are purely material losses. Materially, I didn't lose a lot. But I lost everything. Because by the time, 4 years ago, I had lost myself. Now, I have heard people talk about people having to hit the bottom before they come into AA. And just before this particular period, everybody else had decided that I was an alcoholic. My doctor, my wife, my friends, priests, everybody knew that I was an alcoholic. And everybody thought that AA would be a good thing for me. Well, of course, this was just becoming a darn nuisance. I couldn't get on with my drinking for keeping these folks quiet. And always being a little gentleman, I said, well, I'll go and have a look at this thing they call AA. Mark it, just to keep them quiet. So I went and had a look at AA. And what I saw didn't appeal to me very much. I saw some people that didn't look as though they knew anything about drink at all. And it struck me afterwards, you know, that was a very wrong thing, because in England, we used to advertise a certain patent baby food, and they used to display two photographs, one before and one after. And I thought that was what they should have had at these AA meetings. However, things went from bad to worse. And Ian was lucky. Ian went into hospital under his own steam. I went in on a shutter. And it wasn't very nice. But I came out of that. I had a car crash. I appeared before the magistrate. I got out of that. I was fined heavily, and I had a very nasty restriction put on me. But all... all that really happened, of course, was that I got out of it. Again, I'd been the big shot. I'd got very nicely round then. And now, one day, in our English court, there appeared a right dilapidated gentleman, and the judge looked at him and said, you were drunk. Oh, I was drunk. He said, did you have to get drunk? Oh, aye. Well, did you drink? I drank a bottle of whiskey. But you didn't have to drink a bottle of whiskey. Oh, I have to. He said, why? He says, I lost the cork. But of course, if you, if that old benign judge had known as much about alcoholics as you good people do, He'd have known that the right dilapidated gentleman didn't lose the cork, he threw the damn thing away. And of course, that's just what I'd been doing for 15 years, throwing the cork away and as many corks as I could get hold of. But things became terribly sticky. People were being really awkward about this drinking business, and I didn't like it. Until eventually one day, I went on a business trip into the south of England. And when I came back, there was a message saying that I was suspended and that my department had no further use for me. I went down to London and I sat on a seat on the embankment, which is so well known in literature and history, and I watched the River Thames flowing by. I was still quite confident that I would get a job. I'd always had a job. I'd always had a job that gave me the sort of things that I wanted. And then it suddenly hit me between the eyes, how long will it be before you're looking for the next one? And how long before the one after that? And I went into the head of this particular department, and I pleaded with him to let me go back to my home station and start off where I'd left. And bless his kindly heart, he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, I don't know what you've got at the back of your mind, but you've got something that you didn't have before. And I went back to Birmingham, and I went back to an AA meeting. But this time there was a difference. Formerly, I had been in an AA group. This time, I was of an AA group. I was very upset, very mixed, very muddled. I'd solved the physical part of drinking. I'd accepted the fact that I had a disease. I could follow that. My brain, my technical brain could follow it. But it wasn't until I met my first baby, Ian, that I really got on to the AA program. Now, you will notice that I didn't say to you, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm putting the cart before the horse. Because when we proposed coming here, I looked up St. Louis on an atlas, and it said St. Louis was named after a crusader king of France. Thank you and goodbye, fellow crusaders.
Discount the tremendous effects on AA that our ladies bring. Both our lady alcoholics and the wives of our male members. Tremendous. Those of you who had occasion to write to New York back in 1940, early part of 41, remember that all the letters in New York was signed R. Period Hock. H-O-C-K was the last name. After I received my first one, I wrote back, Dear Mr. Hock. And it wasn't until these two chaps came up from Chicago that I found out that R meant Ruth. Ruth Hock. She was the correspondent, and I was writing to Mr. Hock. I met Ruth years later in Cleveland. She was very happily married at that time. I recall, too, that my sponsors, my Chicago sponsors, impressed on me the necessity for getting hospitalization for our new baby. And so, after the Saturday Evening Post article hit the street, I'm down at our general hospital with my book under one arm and a lot of zeal. And I want to talk to the doctor, some ward that could take care of the drunk.
And I find that the doctor in charge of that particular ward, Ward H, was a woman, Dr. Charlotte Miller. And, I go to work on her. And she said, yes, yeah, she'd heard vaguely of it from the East, but she had a gal whom she had tried with for years, and if I could help her, I could have a hospital. I said, look, I only got one guy, and I'm not sure of him. And I don't want to tackle women until I got about 20 guys. Because I'd had plenty of experience with women alcoholics. I got shy of them. Well, you get shy of the plate after a while, too, when you get beamed. So, that was their ultimatum. So I said, all right. I took the address. I called the girl. She said she'd meet us on the front porch. I took Freddie along for protection. For a witness. Well, anyway, we meet this gal on the front porch, and she was a very tall gal. She had on a pair of very big black glasses, and it developed that she had a sprained ankle. We were going to be big sports and take her to a movie, but this ankle prevented it, so we settled for a cup of coffee. And she took these glasses off. She had two big black eyes. Somebody had socked her, I guess. But she believed it. And the next day, we got a hold of $5 and rented a club room. Because we both, neither one of us had a home, and we had to have a club room. We got a chair with a pillow, and we put her foot up on this pillow, and I went up and talked the telephone company out of a telephone, private line, and we put the phone number in the paper under Cedric's column there, and we were in business. And in a couple of weeks, I took this doctor from the hospital out to see her, and she was a transformed woman, and she gave us the hospital. And we didn't louse it up for 2 whole years. Our next speaker started her AA, was exposed to AA in the beginning in Houston, Texas. And she moved from there to Dallas in 1943, and she was instrumental in the start of the Dallas group. I give you Esther Elizardi.
I never got out, but I you try to talk about AA and what AA has done to me, that I don't always hope that I can say something immortal. But I've been in for a long time, so don't hold your breath, I won't. I had to laugh when Pat was talking about going to see the woman with the black eyes. At least you could hide that. If you tried to come see me, you'd take me to a picture show. My life was just one series of bangs after another. I knocked out my two front teeth. Broke my toe, and my dress caught on fire, and I didn't sit down for 4 months. I just never got to go anywhere. Well, I think in all AA meetings, we usually say we are alcoholics, and I'm from Texas, so we have a little longer introduction. We have sort of bigger and better things, as you all know. So, I'm Esther, and I'm an alcoholic. And from following the program of AA to the best of my ability, I have been dry since May 1941. It's rather hard, I guess, for all of you to see me clean and sober tonight, this afternoon, to ever think that I was in the condition that I was when I came into AA. I had a very happy younger life, though I was born and raised in New Orleans, Louisiana. We had wine and liqueurs in the house all the time. There was never anything that was taboo. And in fact, for dinner, I would have claret with ice and sugar in it when I was a little girl. And on state occasions, every now and then, we'd have creme de menthe poured over ice with a little straw. And it was like a snowball. I don't know if you all know what snowballs are. But never did I ever know what the effect really was. It was wine with dinner and this sort of watery creme de menthe and things like that. And the first time that I think I realized what alcohol could do for me was the night that I married. All my life I had been an extremely sensitive person. I had been hard-headed and mean, and so self-conscious that it hurt all over. And I was having this big throat wedding. And all that day I was frightened dead that I wasn't going to be what I wanted to be. I was afraid my dress wouldn't fit right, that the church wouldn't be crowded, that I would stumble maybe and fall. And I was just in a panic. And in those days, you know, I'm not young. I was married so long ago. And in that day and time, you didn't have a little orchid when you walk up the aisle. You didn't have your picture taken 2 or 3 days before. The photographer came to the house 2 hours before the ceremony and posed you with this huge bouquet like a gangster funeral say, you know, hold it. And being as self-conscious as I was, it is still today just agony for me to have a picture made. So I posed this way and that way, and the headdress I had on was made of pearls, and it felt so heavy I knew it was rock. And I just was about to faint when it was time to go to church, and my daddy looked at me and realized how nervous and upset I was. So he turned to this old servant of ours, and he said, "Miss Esther is about to faint." He said, "Would get her a drink." So this cook of ours was a gin head. And so he knew what a drink meant. He brought me a half a glass of bourbon. And down it went. And the church was just 3 blocks from the house, and I got into the car. It was February. It was cold as it could be. And then we were right at the church, and as soon as I got there, they started the music, and I walked up that aisle. And that bourbon went all through me. And I walked up there just like Mae West. I knew how to do it all over again. So, anyhow, you know, that just seemed kind of hard to remember it. I was just up and down. So I don't think that I ever thought too much of it consciously. The subconsciously, it must have registered. Gee, this is good, you know. So after I married, I grew up, it was during the Prohibition era, and I started to drink with all the crowd. I did not drink hardly at all, in fact, not at all, up until the time I married. Then I could hold an awful lot. I brought everybody home. And so just when I passed the line from social into pathological drinking, I do not know. It's a very subtle and a very vicious thing. But pass it on there. And it was in, I was married in 1924. Along around 31, when I was living in Tulsa, it began to cause comment in my particular group of friends. All of us were drinking too much at the time. You know how it was. You bought moonshine in half a gallon, and it's like going on a picnic. You don't leave till all the sandwiches are gone. Well, you never left till all the half gallons were gone. You didn't want to drag the half gallon back, and you'd hate it to leave any in it. So, but I know my husband drank too much. But when it started interfering with the way he felt the next day, he tapered off. But I didn't. And he got, I thought, at the time that I was just with a bunch of sissies that they just didn't know what, how to live. And anyhow, I was in Tulsa and I was in New Orleans and they didn't do things quite like I thought they should do them. So when we moved back to Dallas, it got pretty bad. And my husband became very worried about it. And one morning after coming home and finding me passed out, he asked me why I drank. Well, isn't that a question to ask an alcoholic? Why? Why? Well, if I only knew why, I wouldn't have been in the condition I was in. But anyhow, I thought maybe if I talked to a psychiatrist, it would help. So he said he would find out who to go to And so Frank left, and I got drunk because I had given him my problem. There wasn't anything else to do. And the next morning, I awakened in the asylum. Well, I didn't know what a crazy house was. And in my drunkenness, I consented to go to a private hospital. So I awakened in this bathroom, and I want a cigarette. My purse isn't there. I was so drunk, I didn't even put a robe on. I just had my coat, no bed and slippers. And just a bathroom, not a cigarette in me. I look for a bell, and there's no bell. So I get up and open the door on this hall, crazy people all around me, and a nurse comes and pushes me back in. Well, I couldn't get out of there. I stayed for 17 days, and I would not even talk to the doctor because he wouldn't let me smoke. And I said that I wouldn't talk to him as long as he kept me there. Well, I know now that I couldn't identify myself with these horrible people. I thought, well, I was really maybe in underneath, but I really was nuts. There was a tree right outside my window, and there was a squirrel going up and down, and I was afraid he was going to catch me. Anyhow, on the 17th day, this psychiatrist let me go home. I had hysterics for the first and only time in my life. I just couldn't stand it any longer. And I went home, and I had a trained nurse, and he came out to see me every day for about 2 weeks. And I thought that I cooperated with that man 100% after I came home. But I know now that I didn't. I told him the truth up to a certain point, and then I told him what I wanted to believe about myself. And it went on, sort of, from bad to worse. The next year, my husband was going to New York, and he didn't want to leave me alone. I had just gotten a dog, and I wanted a house. I was living in an apartment. He thought I was better off in a building with people. But I didn't think that an apartment was any place to raise a dog. So I wanted a house. And he said, well, he had to go to New York. He couldn't get a house for me and leave me alone unless my father came to see me. So I got the dog. I got the house. I got a new fur coat. My daddy came out to stay with me. And my husband went to New York, and I got drunk. And so it was just one of those things that I just woke up drunk. I wanted to be good. But anyhow, my father had known about this other experience I'd had in the asylum. So he said, he talked me into taking the Samaritan treatment. Well, I know there's so many graduates of the Samaritan treatment here. I've taken it 3 times. And I say, there's no easy way to sober up, but that's the most excruciating. And it doesn't help because you can leave and drink and it doesn't make you sick. It only makes you sick when the sheets full of that stuff. So my husband has been talking to the minister at our church, and there was a doctor in the congregation that thought he could help me with vitamins. Well, I'd go down and get shot all full of vitamins, and then I'd stop and get my pint. And the vitamins don't keep you sober either. Then we moved down to Houston in 1940. There was nothing else much to try. My minister had worn himself out. We had tried the psychiatry. And so it was a series of getting a doctor in to sober me up. I started off by telling you the bangs I got out of life. Frank didn't know what condition I would be in when he come home. As I say, for 3 months I couldn't sit down. For another, almost that long, my foot was in a cast because the doctor was waiting to find me sober to take it off. He said I'd break my toe all over again. He left it on weeks longer than he should have. So one afternoon, I was taking my dog for a walk. In fact, I had been down to New Orleans and spent Easter. My husband had to go to New York again, so he took me home to my family and left me there for the month that he was away. And that month, for some reason or other, I didn't take a drink. When I got back to Houston, the week following Easter, so darn proud of myself, I didn't know what to do. And Frank went to work that day, and I saw him drinking. And about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I had to take my dog for a walk. And I don't walk straight sober, but you should see me when I'm drunk. So we weaved down the street, and a cruising car passed. And I guess they wanted to take me home, but I got a little bit sassy. So they had me in the car, in the dog, and we brought the dog home, and they took me to jail. Just plain drunk. Nothing else, not serving tea. So I was completely, I was furious, and I was as drunk as I could be, and I think I must have gone just sort of haywire on the inside when I realized where I was. I know now later they called my husband right away and told him that he knew jail wasn't any place for me, but they were afraid to leave me in this house by myself. And then I was in such foul shape that they thought if he left me for a couple hours to cool off, it would be all right. So Frank came down for me. And during that time that I was in the jail, I remember going back on the bunk and just crying in, oh, just sobbing my heart. And I now know that I just was so completely baffled by myself, my behavior, getting in situations like that, I just didn't know which way to turn. But when the policeman came to get me out of the cell, there was this bar gate, and my husband was signing this ticket, you know, he paid the $5 drunk fine, and I was so mad, and I looked at him, and I said, don't you sign anything in this place. You see, I was going to sue the city of Houston for doing that to Mrs. Ella Dollar. But Frank looked around at me, and he said, Esther, he says, remember, you're in jail. You're not at home. And I never, ever want anybody to look at me like that again. It was just about 2 or 3 days after that that he came in my room one morning. I know I didn't draw a sober breath till then. I was frightened to death. And it was all a subconscious fear. I didn't know what was wrong, but I just couldn't stay sober. And Frank came in this morning and he threw a magazine on the bed. And he had held on to it for so long because I had resented everything he had ever done to try to help, that he was afraid to let me read this article. He was afraid maybe I wouldn't want what the article had to offer me. A friend of ours had sent it to him, and it was a Saturday Evening Post article of AA. He said, I'm not going to lecture you, but when I leave, read this article. And he said, if you want to try this, I'll go with you all the way. But he said, if you don't, you're going to have to go home because I cannot sit by and watch you destroy yourself any longer. So when he left, I had the gate, and I can't see very good, even with my glasses on, and I had a hangover. I can't see at all. I just can't read. I can't do anything. These people that could read the Texas story to sober up on got me. I had to look at pictures and it had to be great big pictures. But I thought, well, I just have to have a cup of drinks for my eyes to focus. So I got a cup of drinks inside underneath my belt and put on the specs and started reading. And from the moment that I read what AA has to say, I wanted it. I don't know if something happened. To me, after a little over 14 years in AA, there is so much awe about it. I would love to be able to say, tell you all how and why it works. I would like to be able to define it. But to me, it's a growing life, and it's a safe definition. It is it's something that it can't be taught, it has to be taught. It's a believing spirit setting other believing spirits to fire. And I think the most wonderful thing about it is it can be achieved in any walk of life because the achievement is not ours, it is God's. And I believe that there is no situation too desperate, none too difficult, nor any unhappiness too great to be overcome in this life-saving venture, Alcoholics Anonymous.
To inform you that she forgot to mention that due to the lease we have on the property here, we agreed to no smoking in the opera house. So please, conform. You know, we're 20 years old now, and some of us are frustrated that we haven't got a million members. Well, some 65 or 70 years ago, my friends, there was a certain Dr. Trudeau in New York City who contracted what was then called consumption. And when you contracted consumption in those days, you made out your will and you prepared to die. That was it. He had it. I think he got it from his brother. He made out his will, he sold his practice, and he moved up to Saranac Lake in a little red cottage, fishing cottage. That little cottage is still there. It's a shrine. Trudeau was a man of deep spiritual nature, out of courage, a man of detail. He kept a daily diary of what he did. And he worked out a therapy of rest, relaxation, freedom from worry, and diet, and so on. And he arrested successfully his disease and knew how he did it. And from that humble beginning, we have the tremendous TB associations of today. I don't know how many TB hospitals in your state have been closed, but we've had a lot of them closed up in our state. It's rapidly shrinking as a problem. Now that's 65 or 70 years ago, my friend. And nowadays when somebody goes before the portable x-ray and he finds a spot, they send him somewhere else to confirm it. And when they tell him he's got it, he goes out and he does what they tell him. That day will come for us, my friend. As you and I live, we will pass the word along by our example that here is how to arrest alcoholism and be happy about it. You are the living example, and we are the pioneers in this business. 100 years from now, they will bless you. Remember, you have a message to carry. And we've got a man here from Beverly Hills, California today with a message. He carried it in lots of places. He originated in the Midwest, Kentucky-Indiana border. He did his preliminary drinking out here in the Midwest. He took his postgraduate course in alcoholism out in California. He graduated out there, and he also had his disease arrested out there. He's been a very popular speaker at many state and regional conventions, and I'm sure I want to sit over there in his seat now because this is a blind spot here and I haven't been able to hear the speakers myself. But I understand you can hear him over in Chuck's chair. The next speaker, ladies and gentlemen, is Chuck Chamberlain of Beverly Hills, California.
Thank you, Bob. And good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I think this would be an awful good time for us to take the other 28 minutes of Ann's period of silence. In the last 2 days, I have heard everything that I would like to say said so much better than I can say it. But the only thing I feel reasonably sure of right now is that I think I know how a spare tire feels. You know. And in the very short time that we have together, you know, I can't get warmed up in 20 minutes. I don't even get in high gear until about 35. I think about all I'll be able to say is to express my eternal gratitude to this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's pretty wonderful when people get into the condition that I was in 10 years ago, that there is a place to come, that there is a program by which we can gain and maintain our sobriety. Had this not been true, I would have departed for the areas about 9 years ago. And I'm so grateful I can't see. And when I think that drunks like ourselves, with no program of recovery, worked out this wonderful program of ours, by trial and error, with no precedent, and came up with a foolproof program, such as was here when I needed it, I am so grateful that I can't see. I am sure that it had it been left to me, all of you that came after me would have been dead too. I have two or three admirers out on the coast, and every once in a while they get up and eulogize at me quite highly, you know, in an introduction. And there's nothing that tickles me so much. I just sit back there and laugh way down deep, because I read Jack Alexander's article in 1941, and I was already going down for the third time. And it took me until January 1946 to get here. I knew it was there, too. Oh, me. And since I could not get sober and stay sober, try as I might, there is nothing within me that even wants to believe that I might maintain sobriety by myself. I believe that the most meaningful words to me in Alcoholics Anonymous are these. AA is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other. Share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they might solve their common problem and help other people recover from alcoholism. Ah, how terrific those words are. And I'm mindful of that day, that night, rather, in January, 9.5 years ago, when I walked into my first meeting alone. I had a camel's hair coat left. We don't wear them very often out there, so I had it left. And it had a big collar on it, and I had the collar pulled up around my face and my hat pulled over, and I walked into this meeting alone. And a very fine looking gentleman walked up to me and stuck out his hand. He says, "Are you looking for somebody?" And I said, "No, sir." And he says, what are you doing here? And I says, I'm looking for sobriety. And he says, brother, you're in the right place. He didn't ask me for a letter of recommendation. He didn't ask me where I'd been last night. He just says, you're in the right place. Take off your hat and coat and come in. And they shared their experience, strength, and hope with me. And they were total strangers to me. And here they were, sharing their experience, strength, and hope, when the people that knew me didn't. And these are wonderful words in my book, that we share our experience, strength, and hope with each other. I love Bill's little definition of this fellowship. That A is just one alcoholic helping another, and the two of them helping somebody else. I never had the privilege of having a sponsor on this program, except that every one of them are sponsors, whether you know it or not, or whether you like it or not. And so, I think the thing that I took away from me, from that first meeting, more than anything else, was that spirit of fellowship. I think we have two things in AA. We have spirit and principles. And I think it's by the spirit that we get sober, and by the practice of the principles that we remain sober. Reminds me of a little thing that happened to me in San Diego. I had been the speaker down there one evening, and it was a rather large meeting, and I talked from a high stage. And after the meeting was over, I was last in the coffee line, and it was a pretty long line, and I was standing back there commiserating with myself. When an old boy walked up to me and he had a thing in his ear and a battery hanging on him, and he says, you were the speaker, weren't you? And I says, I think it was. And he says, eh? I says, yes. And he says, I got a question I'd like to ask you. And I says, what is it? He says, eh? I says, what is it? He says, I asked this question of a panel a while back and they couldn't answer it. And I yelled at him to go ahead. And he says, can you tell me how a man can come to this program and get sober and stay sober when he came here a goddamn wicked man? And after I'd found my voice, I yelled at him and I told him, no, I couldn't answer it. And he says, well, there is a spirit here. Now, he says, I couldn't hear anything that was said tonight, but I think I know everything that was said. And certainly there is a spirit here. And it's this spirit that we must maintain forever. You see, other people have had these principles. These principles of ours are not new. They are in every great religion that there is. And so the principles are not new to us, but the spirit is new in our lives. And it must be that we dedicate ourselves. And there is no better time than this 20th anniversary. That we must rededicate ourselves to the little shore of keeping this spirit in Alcoholics Anonymous. This spirit of sharing our experience, strength, and hope one with another. I believe that there's nothing in life that is quite so wonderful in my own livingness. As to see a man or a woman as sick as I was 10 years ago, and watch them over a period of a few months come back to normalcy, and through normalcy to a happy, peaceful, and joyous way of life. I liken it to an inside shower. It does something to us that nothing else ever will. And so this is one of the great dividends of sharing our experience, strength, and hope with each other. This is one of the things that shoves the past way back, so that pretty soon we can laugh with it and at it. This is one of the things that make life for us so much different and so much better. I often hear said from a podium that this is a simple program, but it isn't easy. And I have to laugh again, way down deep inside. This is the only easy life I've ever known. It wasn't easy for me to stay drunk. It wasn't easy at all. It is pretty rough. And so I believe that the program is simple and easy in direct proportion to how badly we want it. If we want sobriety more than life itself, we find this about the easiest thing that we've ever done. And I liked Wynn's little remark yesterday afternoon about how the thing works. Every once in a while, I hear somebody say they don't know how it works. And I get a great kick out of that, too. Because we have a chapter 5 in our book that says how it works. You know, that's the title of it. And I'm just simple enough to believe that's the way it works. Just simple enough. I think that's it. I didn't come here to investigate. I didn't come here to find out how to drink socially. I didn't even come here hoping for physical health. I came here hoping against hope that I might find a way to stay sober until I die. And I didn't think that was very long, because I wasn't in what one of the good doctors this morning would have called a state of robust health. I wasn't. I didn't think I had very long. But it was important to me to be sober for such time as I had left, because I'd had that rare period of insight a few days previous to this, when I'd been able to see myself as I was. And I knew that I was licked. I knew that I was all done. And I knew that I couldn't get out of this thing alone. And I knew that my good wife couldn't do anything other than what she was doing. And that was getting rid of me. And I knew that the boys couldn't feel any differently than they did. And that was that they couldn't wait until she got rid of me. And I knew that the boss couldn't do anything other than what he was going to do. And that was to throw me through the plate glass window out into Alameda Street if I ever showed up down there again. And that's not good, because Alameda Street is very heavily traveled, and it's all trucks out there. Big trucks. Something else that was very much more important to me. I knew why, and it was me. And so it was important to me that I be sober for such time as I had left, because I wanted to do what I could to rub out what I'd already written on the blackboard of life. And that's the only reason that I wanted to be sure. I hadn't the slightest thought that these myriad problems that I had might be solved. And as I told you, I wasn't even expecting physical help. I just wanted to be sober so that I might erase as much as I could of what I'd already written. And so when they read that chapter, How It Works, I believed it. And I just started trying to fulfill those conditions. Just trying to fulfill those conditions. And I had no ability. But I had a great desire to do what I could to fulfill those conditions. And I want to say to you, that I do not believe that it takes any ability, because I had none. And again, that if we want this thing more than life, that we find it pretty easy. Because I just started in trying one day at a time to do what I could to fulfill the conditions of this program. And the conditions are not so rough when they become important. And what are the conditions? Number one, surrender. Both physical and mental surrender. Because this is a physical and mental disease. We admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable, physical and mental. Surrender. To get out of her own way. To see that a life lived by self-will can hardly be satisfactory. To see that life as we are living is worthless. And to see that we, as we are not worth the powder to blow us to hell. Surrender, complete and utter, both physical and mental. Secondly, the recognition of the need for help from a power greater than ourselves. And I think that's all we need in the first place. Just the recognition of the need for help. And number three, an honest desire and an honest effort to do what we can with what we have today to live according to these principles. And that's all, in my opinion, that there is to it. Just that little deal. Surrender, the recognition of the need for help, and an honest effort to do the best we can with what we have today. And again, I don't think it takes any ability. Just whatever ability that we have, that's all. But it takes all of it. I heard a little remark that I loved so much the other night. That it doesn't take much of a man to make this program. But it takes all of him. It takes all of him. And so it is that when we fulfill these conditions to the best of our ability, we get sober. And we remain sober. And so, after 6 months of attending a meeting every night, I woke up to the fact that I was sober. It took me 6 months even to wake up to the fact that I was sober. So you see, I wasn't very bright. And it took me 3.5 years to get over falling on my face. So I wasn't very strong. But I woke up to the fact that I was sober. And that's 9 years ago. And everything that's happened in my life since then has just happened. And I've awakened to the fact that it's happened. And it's all been good. And I sort of look back over my life have to figure out why it happened and how it happened. And this seems to me to be the problem, and this seems to me to be the answer. I'm just as sure as I stand here that I became an alcoholic because of my inability to integrate myself into a society of which I did not approve. I have never liked so-called normal society, and I don't like it now. Thank God I don't have to live in it. They didn't perform according to my pattern for some reason or another. And I couldn't perform according to theirs because of my own makeup. And so I found alcohol, and it made it a little easier for me to get along in a society that I didn't like. But there was a kick in it, because when I drank, I didn't perform very well either. And I didn't like me for my performance. And when I didn't like me, I had to drink a little bit more and perform a little bit less and like me a little bit less. And finally, the time came when I was caught in the snowball and I couldn't get out and I couldn't live with me and I couldn't die. And so I had to come here. Now all of this time, like all the rest of you, I had had a set of ideals that were way up yonder, but I couldn't perform according to those ideals because my conditioning wouldn't let me. Because of a lot of things that I learned that weren't true. One amongst them was that there is no such word as surrender. I learned that very early. That there wasn't any such word. About 75% of my people are still fighting the Civil War, you know. There was no surrender in my vocabulary. And so, until I was 43 years old, it was impossible for me to surrender. I didn't get these scars on me by agreeing with my adversary quickly, I'll tell you that. And it's a pretty wonderful thing that we can look back on all the experience in those 43 years and thank God for them, because no man knows how freeing surrender is until he has to surrender. It's a terrific thing when we wake up to the fact that all these years spent to keep from surrendering ends up in the knowledge that the only thing that we give up in surrender is our trouble. That's all we give up. That's all. And so I couldn't fulfill the very first condition, to surrender. And I didn't until everything that I held dear in life was gone. And then the time came when I could. And so the problem in my way of thinking is that feeling of conscious separation from. Perhaps the best definition we'll ever hear of Dr. Thibault ego. The feeling of conscious separation from, the thing that made us feel so different than everybody else. The thing that said to me that I had to outthink, outperform, and outmaneuver everybody else in the world in order to eke out a miserable existence out of an unfriendly universe. The thing that said, sure am I, poor little me, or great big me, or smart me, or dumb me, or whatever it is, against everybody. The feeling of conscious separation from is the problem. I think it's the one problem that includes all problems. And the one answer that includes all answers is just the reverse of this. The feeling of conscious unity with, living in, a part of. And that's what we find in this great program of ours. Because we come here for sobriety, and sobriety only. Forgetting all the rest of these problems, we come here for sobriety. We do these things for sobriety and sobriety only. And in the very doing of them, we find the answer to life itself. We find that the conditions for sobriety and the conditions of the good life and the conditions of God are one and the same answer. We find out why it is that a belief in God is good, but not good enough. That for people like us, to live in God is the only answer that there is. And this by accident, because we didn't do these things for these answers. We did them for sobriety. And lo and behold, we find that the answer to the disease of alcoholism and the answer to the riddle of life is one and the same. And it's just a moving out of the feeling of conscious separation from. That feeling of aloneness that eventually is the only feeling that we have. That we're 10 million miles from nothing, even in our own room. That feeling of aloneness is wiped out. And a feeling of unity with, living in, a part of, takes its place. And this, to my mind, is the great miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think we're the most fortunate peoples on the face of the earth, we alcoholics. Because, you see, we did this thing backwards just as long as we could. Just as long as we could. And it was only when we'd run completely out of gas, and then not by choice, but by necessity, because we couldn't live and we couldn't die, then we did it right and found the answer, the living answer to the living problem. We moved back into the circle, and when we got honest enough to practice these principles in all of our affairs. And when we got honest enough, scared me. That light came on. They're going to shut me off. When we got honest enough to sit with ourselves in the quiet, and spend a little time on step 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood it. Praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. We came to see that feeling of conscious separation was all wrong. We came to see that everyone amongst us is our Father's child. Everyone amongst us, our Father's child. We came to see that this was true. Even when we're way out there in left field, consciously separated from. Still, we were our Father's children. But we were away from home. And we came to see that all we had to do was to come back home. Fulfill these simple conditions. Do these simple things. And that we'd find that our Father had always been there, that it was ourselves that were away. And I'm going to close with just a couple of little simple illustrations that had become so very meaningful to me. After many years, I ran on to the fellow here last night from whom I got this little thing, and I won't quote it exactly, but it's been so meaningful in my life, and I've used it so much. It was Big Smith from up in Michigan who brought it to us out there, and he said he had found it in a plaque on a wall in an alcoholic ward down in Texas in a hospital. And the little plaque read like this: if you're not as close to God as you once were or as you would like to be, make no mistake, you're the one that moved. And I thought it was one of the finest sermons I've ever heard. And Smitty went ahead to say, all we have to do is come back home, do these simple things, and we find that God's always been there. And then again, the chap that came up to me one time after one of these meetings, and I was out of sorts, and I didn't want to talk to him or listen to him, and he asked me this question. He says, Chuck, you know why it's so hard for us to find God? I thought, this is all night, you know. And I didn't want to get in a conversation with him at all. But he had me trapped, and I had to say, no, why is it so hard for us to find God? And the kid says, because he ain't lost. Why is this? We're the ones that have been lost. All we have to do is come back home, do these simple things, and we find that God's always been there. And so again, I'm so grateful that I can't see. So grateful to this fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and to its founders, those who went ahead of us, and to you people, all of us. Because you helped me come back home. I am so grateful that I decided I wanted what you had that first night and was willing to go to any length to get it. So grateful that I decided to take certain steps because you told me, here are the steps we took. We're sober, which are suggested as a program of recovery. And I decided to take those steps, the 12 steps. So grateful, because in my own experience, I have found that those 12 steps lead all the way from hell to heaven. I know, because that's the way it happened to me. Thank you very much. Well, folks, we've got a time limit on this, as you know. I would like to close the meeting with something that I heard years ago from Clem Lane of Chicago. I don't know where he got it. But it made a very vivid impression on me at the time. I'd like to pass it on to you. Because as you've undoubtedly found out, your anonymity doesn't last too long if you practice these principles
in all your affairs. My friends, you change. You have a new strength, a new serenity, a new spirituality which just oozes out of you, and you can no longer hide the fact that the old fear, anxiety, and anticipation, the negative qualities are gone, and they're replaced by these positive ones. So this is the story of the Happy Prince. Many of you have heard it. And there's a fable from your childhood that explains why, in the natural order, Alcoholics Anonymous works. Let's recall it together, the story of the Happy Prince. There was this happy prince, and everywhere he went, people crowded about him. They were delighted to see him, eager to shower him with love and with praise. Every time he appeared, people ran to tell the neighbors, and great throngs gathered. Now there was a man who saw the love and adulation given the happy prince, and he wanted these things for himself. So looking on the happy prince and his shining countenance, he said, "It's because he's a personable lad. I too could be popular if I was as handsome as he." So the man had a mask made, a replica of the features of the happy prince, and he donned this mask and he went about. But there came to him no shouting crowd, no glad greetings, no love nor praise, nor adulation. "There must be other things," said the man, and he began to follow the happy prince, to spy on him in all his doings. And he found that always and ever the prince was ready with a heartening word, an act of courtesy, a deed of kindness, that always he sought to help others. So the man said, "If these are the things I must do to win love and praise, Then do these things I will." And so he went about doing the good thing, the unselfish thing, the kindly thing, the honest thing, and the pure thing. For months the man went about doing these things, and there did come to him the love of his fellows and the admiration of the throng. But one day his conscience smote him. "Here I am," he said, "doing all these things, seeking just to win love and praise, pretending that I am the happy prince." And he reached up to pull the mask from his face, but the mask would not come off. He was the happy prince. That's the moral, my friends. You are the happy prince. All my confreres here, thank you very much. And we'll close, please, with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever. Amen.